I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. We have the second of our interviews for this week with the writer Henry Hemmings, who has written an extraordinary book, Four Shots in the Night, the story of one of the British Army's most kind of controversial, and the British intelligence most controversial intelligence operations in Northern Ireland, using the double agent Steak Knife, who this is recently, if you're in the UK, has been appeared again. This story has appeared in the UK news. If you're not listening to this from the UK and are not familiar or in a depth way with the issues of Northern Ireland, we're going to speak about that a little bit here. But firstly, before I do anything else, I'd love to welcome Henry to the podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Nick, and thank you for having me on. It's really good to be here.
Okay, fabulous. So firstly, very quickly, let's talk about how the book came about. How did this become your area of interest?
Yeah, so I've written books in the past about spies and intelligence and espionage. I've mostly focused on Second World War spy stories. And I had a conversation about 5 years ago with someone who said something along the lines of, you do realise that the biggest story in the history of British intelligence from the last 70 years is that of spies inside the IRA during the Troubles. And I'll be totally honest, I did not know that. And I was quite skeptical when I first heard it. And obviously my focus was elsewhere. But I began to look into this more and more. I began to speak to people with experience of being in Northern Ireland, and people had memories of being there during the Troubles. And I began to understand that there was actually a really interesting story, one which I wanted to investigate further, one which hadn't been told in a mainstream book like the one that I came to write, Four Shots in the Night. And, you know, at this stage, it was still just a subject I was interested in. But everything changed when I read about one particular murder that took place during the Troubles. And I'll tell you just a couple of things about it. It was the murder of a man called Frank Hegarty. And it was a murder that was believed to have been carried out by the IRA. And very soon it emerged that this man, Frank Hegarty, had been working for the British as an undercover agent. He'd been a spy. And that was interesting in itself. I began to was curious about what he was doing and how he ended up being killed and all of these things. But what really changed everything was when I heard the allegation that the man inside the IRA who had killed him was also a British spy. In other words, there could have been two spies inside the same paramilitary organization, and one was given the order to kill the other. And that's where my interest began to build from. Right. And at around the same time, I found out that this IRA spy, the man who is alleged to have committed the murder, was under investigation. So there's an enormous police operation, a criminal investigation called Operation Canova, focus on this one man. And it's huge. It's 72 detectives, £40 million, had access to thousands of classified government documents. And they were trying to find out what this spy had done. So I was really, that's when I thought, right, this is a story that I want to investigate and one that needs to be told, and crucially, one that can begin to give people a better understanding of roughly what was going on in the shadows in Northern Ireland during the Troubles.
There are various kind of intelligence books you read. Obviously, there's the field of intelligence history is so huge. But one thing that kind of, when you're looking at the workings of the CIA or MI6, there are periods where the kind of like the sort of the things looking like a well-oiled kind of James Bond sort of system of control don't look very much like that. They look like kind of Wild West improvised harebrained schemes with agents that are doing all sorts of things that you don't exactly know about. And is your sense of what was happening here with agents in the IRA that that lots of people were do were kind of out of control, or and or not?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, maybe there are two things I want to say in response to that. And one is to do with scale, and one is to do with oversight. And what I mean by scale is just the number of agents still leaves me astonished. I mean, you refer to spy stories in the past. We think of something like the Cambridge Five. That's one of the most famous spy scandals from 20th century British history. And that's obviously five spies. There was a moment not too long ago when a respected Northern Irishman was given access to classified government information. And he came away saying, "I now know roughly how many agents were operating in Northern Ireland during the Troubles." And everyone's ears pricked up. And he said the number was over 800. So more than 800 agents were being run at any one time. So not cumulatively, but at any one time. And there are some intelligence professionals who think actually the number was even higher than that. So this is an astonishing number. You know, if you told me that there were just 10 or 15 agents operating inside the IRA, I'd be interested. But the idea that there were 800 across the region at any one time is huge. So you've got many more agents than people imagine, and this brings us to the problems, the kind of out of controlness or the lack of oversight. There certainly were occasions when some of the people running these agents did not have enough oversight, did not have enough accountability, did not know what the legal guidelines to what they could and could not do with this intelligence, what they were. And mistakes were certainly made. And maybe I'll try and kind of, it's sounding a bit abstract what I'm talking about. Maybe I'll give you a really kind of precise, concrete example, just to kind of make it all make sense. The man I'm writing about, he's called Frank Hegarty, and he's the man who was killed. My book is basically about a single murder and the question of who did it. And early on in his career as an agent, he's asked by the IRA to look after a small amount of weapons. It's three rifles and some explosives. So he takes these things, he finds a hiding place, buries them, and then he goes to his handler in the army and says, "I've been given these weapons, I put them in this particular place. Over to you." And the question is, what does the handler do? So this is someone, he's a soldier. He doesn't know what the kind of the legal guidelines are. His agent has just committed a crime. You know, does he go straight to the police and say, "My agent has committed a crime"? No, he doesn't. But the main question he's trying to answer is, am I going to save more lives if I act on this intelligence right away? Or am I going to save more lives if I do not? And, you know, maybe to you and me, that sounds like a kind of crazy question. Like, obviously, you go to the police, tell them about the weapons, they take the weapons out of circulation as quickly as possible. However, if he were to do that, then the IRA would know straight away that this agent is an agent. He would be taken away and he would, without doubt, be shot, be killed. So by passing on this information, you're effectively allowing the life of your agent to be taken. I wouldn't say you're actually killing this person, but you are, yeah, putting him in extreme danger. And the other thing to throw into the mix is that if these weapons are not taken away from their hiding place, then your agent might become more trusted. And that means that in future, he might get even better information. And that means that in future, you'll be in a position to save even more lives. And so already the whole sort of calculation is becoming more difficult because, you know, you can't see into the future. You don't know whether this man's going to be more trusted and whether he's going to receive fantastic information. And maybe the one other thing to add is that you've got enormous time pressure. So you don't have weeks to think about this. You don't have all your lots of colleagues to consult and time to really ponder. You usually have to make a decision like this in a matter of hours. And in this particular instance, the army handler decides to do nothing. Okay. So these weapons, they have a good look at them, they take them out of the hiding place and check their ballistic signatures, but then they put them exactly back where they found them. And these weapons are later taken on by the IRA, and some of them are used. And that's something I refer to in the book, in Four Shots in the Night, as the spy master's dilemma. And it was being faced by agent handlers in Northern Ireland on a sometimes daily basis. But it's also something that you find throughout the history of intelligence. Go back as far as you like, go back to sort of biblical times, and you'll find that agent runners or spy masters or agent handlers, whatever you want to call them, they're always going to be facing these kinds of dilemmas. And I think that's one of the things that really comes to the fore in the story of what's going on in Northern Ireland. There are so many of these incredibly difficult moral and practical decisions about what you do with intelligence. And what makes it harder is that there's more of this intelligence than they're used to because of the scale of this operation.
It's interesting. I was having this conversation with another historian just a couple of days ago on this podcast about how basically spies and policemen often work at cross purposes. And there is, you may have read an excellent book on the causes of 9/11 called The Looming Tower by Lawrence Wright. And he strips away a lot of the conspiracy theory stuff and basically says at a certain point, you have this huge mistake when the FBI and the CIA are talking at cross purposes. I'm not sharing information. The FBI want to arrest people. The CIA want to spy on people, and they refuse to cooperate. They had the two pieces of the puzzle that could have led to the hijackers being arrested, and they wouldn't. They kept their toys, And I think post 9/11, you have a very very different way of doing things, obviously. But it's a similar sort of principle.
Absolutely.
Very briefly, I mean, I think it's worth just for those who are kind of perhaps have grown up after the Good Friday Agreement, just to give a kind of like a very brief kind of 2 minute kind of overview of what the period of the Troubles from say the late 1960s were and what they were about. Is there a kind of a way of kind of summarizing
Yeah, I
that?
think there is. And it's certainly, I think there are three ingredients, if you like, that form the troubles. And I think quite often people will forget one or two of them and focus on just a single ingredient. But yeah, there are three things. So it begins as a civil rights campaign. So it begins with people on the streets of Derry and in Belfast campaigning for one thing. And it's really simple, it's really clear. They want to end discrimination against Catholics in Northern Ireland. And so there are Catholics and Protestants who are campaigning for this. They're inspired by what's going on in America with the civil rights campaign there. And this is a completely simple, clear, valid, and entirely overdue campaign. And it's a peaceful campaign. And the reaction to that from the police, which is dominated by Protestants, begins to create the second ingredient of the Troubles, which is a sectarian conflict. So you begin to have mostly Catholic groups fighting against Protestant groups, and it's often young men, and then that escalates into something more. You have Catholics living in mostly Protestant areas who are forced out of that area, and then vice versa, Protestants living in Catholic areas who are forced to leave their homes. So first of all, you've got the civil rights campaign. Second of all, you've got this sectarian conflict of Protestants versus Catholics, something which really had not flared up in the months and the few years before the Troubles began. I mean, it's worth adding, at the start of the Troubles, Northern Ireland was one of the most peaceful places on earth, with an average of just 5 murders per year. And the contrast to what happens later in the Troubles is just astonishing. And the third ingredient is when this sectarian conflict gets out of hand, in the sense that the police are no longer able to contain it. People are losing their lives. That's when the British government gets a call from the Northern Irish government who are saying, "Help. We
Yeah.
really we need assistance right now because people are getting killed."
And there's,
And
I was going to say, there was a sense from looking at the Heath and the Wilson government, the Wilson and Heath governments of the late 60s and into the early 70s, of the penny not dropping with them for quite a while, that this is going to get really serious.
Yeah. And
And
they don't know what to do. They're initially they send in the army, and that's the other big factor in the troubles. So suddenly you have British soldiers patrolling the streets of British streets, and this hasn't happened for decades and decades. These soldiers, they're not trained to do this. They really don't know what they're doing. They're used to fighting overseas. They're used to going on training exercises, preparing for a Cold War conflict versus Russian forces. They're not kitted out to be preventing sectarian conflict on the streets of Northern Ireland. And but at the same time, to begin with, this seems to work. So for the first 3 or 4 months, the army is on the streets of Northern Ireland, and the violence becomes less. So the situation seems to be improving. And everyone's beginning to think, phew, it's we've solved this problem. Soon the army can be on its way. But the presence of the army becomes, in a way, a kind of recruiting sergeant for this breakaway faction of the IRA called the Provisional IRA. And this breakaway faction is absolutely committed to one thing, and that is violently removing the British from Northern Ireland. So taking on the army and taking them on in a military campaign, and their one aim is to bring about unification. So for Northern Ireland to be part of the Republic of Ireland, that's exactly what they're looking for. So there you go. You've got these three ingredients, and they feed off each other. Some are more prominent than others at different moments. It's a civil rights campaign, it's a sectarian conflict, and it's an insurgency against the British Army. And what becomes terrifying is that quite soon it becomes clear that there's enough in these three conflicts to keep this going indefinitely.
Yeah.
And that's when people in London and people in Belfast begin to start thinking, right, we need a radical solution. We have to do something unusual. And ultimately, after about 10 years, they decide to really put the focus on intelligence and using undercover agents.
So with Agent State Knife, at what point was he active within the IRA as an agent?
Yeah, it's a really interesting story. He's a man called Freddie Scappaticci. He's a Belfast bricklayer, and he joins the IRA very early on in the Troubles, and he's part of various campaigns. But then he's kicked out, so he's removed from the IRA, mainly because he was sounding off about some local IRA bigwigs. And he's furious about this. He's really angry. He wants to get revenge. That's an important part of his motivation. And around about this time, I won't get into all the details, but around about this time, he has a conversation with a young British soldier, and they begin to meet up. They begin to go for drinks, and eventually, the soldier recruits him as an agent for the army. And at the time, he's not even in the IRA. But eventually he finds a way to get back inside. So he gets back inside the IRA. He begins to provide the British with really valuable intelligence. There's tactical intelligence about where a bomb is going to go off or where an attack is going to take place. But there's also strategic intelligence. So Scappaticci is close to Gerry Adams. He's close to other senior IRA figures. And he's able to pass on this information or gossip about what's going on within the senior IRA echelons. And that becomes valuable for the British as well.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
But at some point, and I was never able to find out exactly when this happened. Hopefully this detail will emerge at some point. But at some point, Scappaticci is told to join a different part of the IRA. So someone in the IRA says, we want you to become part of the Nutting Squad. And the Nutting Squad is the most terrifying part of the IRA. This is the unit which is dedicated to abducting and interrogating suspected spies. And if the order then comes from the army council of the IRA for this person to be killed, then the Nutting Squad usually is the one to carry out the murder. So Scappaticci is suddenly part of this particular unit. Mm-hmm. And there's this is where it becomes much more complicated and morally more problematic. The British are now receiving from Scappaticci even better intelligence than before. But at the same time, the price to pay for this is that Scappaticci is almost certainly involved in a number of murders. And according to the report that came out last month, he may have been involved in as many as 14 murders during his time inside the Nutting Squad while he was still passing on information. And the basic question we're left with is, was it worth it? Should the British have just cut all ties and said, right, now that you're in the Nutting Squad, we want nothing to do with you, you're on your own? Should they have tried to prosecute him? Should they have told the police about what they believed he was up to? This is the question that people will be debating for many years to come. And certainly the report that came out last month felt that on too many occasions, the agent handlers turned a blind eye to what Scappaticci or Steak Knife, to what he was doing, and that they were wrong to do so as many times as they did.
And was his role within as an agent, is there kind of demonstrable evidence that his role as an agent had kind of significant benefits as far as defeating the IRA and working towards peace?
This is a really, how exactly do you quantify that? So in the police report that came out last month, they put the estimate that about there were 10 occasions, they think, roughly 10 occasions, when Scappaticci's intelligence directly led to one life being saved. So that's a case of him saying, I know the IRA are going to go and kill so-and-so on this particular day. And then so-and-so would be removed from that place, or the police would make sure they were there when the attack was going to happen to prevent it. So there are about 10 occasions when that happened. But you also have occasions when Scappaticci's intelligence corroborated something else, so it confirmed another report. But there were also many occasions when his intelligence led to a bomb not being planted or an attack against soldiers not taking place. Then those occasions weren't included in the report.
These are the operations that the IRA would have called off.
Exactly, yeah. And the one other thing to add is just the overall effect on the IRA. So there's good evidence that by the early 1990s, parts of the IRA were finding it really hard to function in a military sense. In other words, according to one estimate, 9 out of 10 operations are being called off. And most of the time they're being called off because intelligence work meant that somebody knew it was going to take place. And so the IRA volunteers would abandon that particular operation. And the effect of this was that more and more volunteers would begin to think, okay, we don't think a military victory is within reach. perhaps a political solution is more realistic. And that's what the British were trying to achieve. So, but it's really hard to quantify that. You can't put a number on the effect of that. And that's what makes this a much harder thing to try and measure than some people think.
And I suppose those who, you know, in MI6 and other organisations that would seek to defend their reputations would say, this is an ugly business. This is, yes, you run agents like this, and yes, they do things like that, and yes, you have to do, you have to. They probably won't say anything at all, actually, but I presume that's kind of the argument.
Yeah, you're right. It is. I mean, it's basically the argument. But to be more precise, the one of the things the police report said repeatedly, which I found really interesting, it made a really specific criticism of just the way that people from the intelligence community would talk about Scappaticci. And the criticism was that they talked about Scappaticci in an almost sort of mythic way, as in this agent has saved countless lives or hundreds of lives. And this I find really interesting, that basically the thrust of the police report is saying that they thought he was so good, they stopped thinking about exactly what he was providing and exactly what he was doing. Mm. He became this sort of this revered figure, and all of the mythology surrounding him in some ways protected him. And I find that interesting, and there's probably something in that.
Well, it's I think there's a bit in one of Le Carré's novels where there's some, so I think it's in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, where somebody says, likens bad intelligence to a fake painting. And they say, but the more you've paid for the painting, the more you want to believe it's the real thing. And the more, you know, the more that was invested in Steak Knife, the more likely people were to go, but yes, I know he's perhaps a bit of a rogue, but you know, look at the wondrous outcomes.
Yeah.
And that's the price, I suppose. That's the price people are willing to pay for this kind of this kind of intel.
I mean, and at one point in this police report, the author of the report, John Boucher, who's now chief constable of the police service in Northern Ireland, he said it was actually, he wonders, he speculates, if it's the irony of having an agent inside the IRA squad that's devoted to finding agents, that maybe that was also something that led to those in the intelligence community just thinking this is such a wonderful thing to have an agent deep inside this particular unit. We couldn't even think of giving him up. That maybe that played a part in it as well. But yeah, no, I'd forgotten about that line from Tinker Tailor. And it's good.
How did Scappaticci manage to survive as long as he did in the IRA? I mean, they were no fools, the IRA. You know, how did he manage to avoid suspicion?
Well, maybe I refer you back to the quote you just gave from Tinker Tailor, that he'd played such an important part within the IRA. He'd spent so long inside it. And he'd known so much and become so close to so many senior figures that even when people began to have their suspicions, they realized it was actually in their interest to not act on those and to not pursue them. And perhaps at an almost unconscious level, you put them to one side, because the idea that this guy you've trusted with so much information could have been passing it all on this whole time is just too terrifying to contemplate. It's the same feeling of having bought a fake painting.
Yeah. I mean, and my sense of, say, for example, you mentioned the Cambridge spies previously, my sense of as an explanation to kind of Filby and Burgess, and particularly Filby, because he was so senior, was exactly that of, I, you know, this cannot possibly be true, because if it is true, it would be too terrible to be true. And so we're just not going to entertain that this is true. And until, of course, and coming back to the question of spies versus policemen, if memory serves me correctly, the person that first really rumbled Filby was an FBI man when he was in America, and said, look, the number of operations that have fallen apart that are associated with this guy, it can't be coincidence. And obviously it wasn't. And just recently, I mean, we were just speaking about this before the recording began. This has recently been in the news, hasn't it? The interim report is now out, and I guess the story of Steak Knife is set to continue. There will be further information about this. Room for a sequel, perhaps.
Yes, there will be. And I what I've yeah one of the things that I hope my book Four Shots in the Night will be able to bring to this conversation is I've been able to tell the story of how Steak Knife was recruited, but also how he was run in those early days, which hasn't been told before. And I think that's one of the things that's really missing from the police report, which is obviously focused on just the conclusion of what were mistakes made and were criminal activities undertaken? And I think from a historical point of view, you've got a different agenda to someone who's just pursuing criminal justice. And yeah, what I've tried to do is tell the broader story of who this person was, what was motivating him, how he agreed to become an agent in the first place, and what kind of moral dilemmas he had himself. Because it's interesting that he was trying as hard as he could to supply information against the IRA, but he was also very much a part of it. And I find that's that inner conflict one that's yeah that one that needs to be explored much more. But in answer to your question, yes, there will be more about Steak Knife in the months ahead. I've no doubt about that. And I think especially the fact that Steak Knife died last year, that means from a libel sense, people are
Oh
much
yeah.
more free to talk about what he may or may not have done.
Yes, you can really go for it now, can't you? I think that the final thing to say is this question of motivation. I mean, if you look at Philby, for example, you have this mixture of kind of ideology and arrogance and probably a large amount of alcoholism, I think, reading between the lines. It's true. I mean, but motivated from, as far as he was concerned, ostensibly by, these are the beliefs that I have. And, he said always that he'd never viewed himself as a British intelligence officer. He said he was a Soviet officer right from the beginning who had infiltrated MI6. And that's how he saw himself. I find it interesting. And sometimes I wonder if there's something more to all of this. Scappaticci is motivated by revenge. Because he's been rejected. Did he have any more kind of noble sort of, for want of a better word, motivations? Or is it really very personal for him?
I think for any spy, your motivation will change over the days, months, years that you're doing this. And I think the reason that someone begins to be a spy is often very different to what keeps them going 2 years down the line, 5 years, 10 years down the line. I mean, certainly with Philby, and I think there's an analogy here to Scappaticci. Philby, I'll never forget the way he talked about what it was like to first meet Arnold Deutsch, his first handler, or the person who first persuaded him to become a spy, and how he was intoxicated by this meeting. He thought this guy was fantastic. He felt that this guy was intelligent and interesting and cultured and understood him in a way that no one else did. So that human connection was so important. And in a really similar way, Scappaticci's connection to this soldier, this man who's been referred to in the media as Peter, was really important. And it began, their relationship began with almost a year of just going for drinks in pubs, chatting about non-political stuff. So they formed a genuine friendship before the soldier said, by the way, how about we talk about some other things as well on the more political side of it. So that was definitely a part of it. But was there some kind of noble motivation later on? I like to think there was. I like to think that was certainly one element of it. I'm not for a second saying that the only reason he was doing this was simply because he believed in peace and he wanted to end the troubles as soon as possible. But that must have been a part of it. And there he is, he's providing information that's preventing attacks, that's preventing killings from taking place. And we also know that he took many steps to try and get out of taking part in some of the IRA killings that he probably ended up taking part in. So there is, I don't think he's a man without morals, is maybe the best way of putting it.
No. Well, this podcast is, if nothing else, about the complexities of human beings. So but there we must draw to a close. Anyway, let's do the quick plug. So the book is Four Shots in the Night, available, I'm guessing, in all good bookshops.
Absolutely.
If you want to buy this, please do try to support your independent book retailer. They're very, very important, and we always really kind of emphasize that at the end of each podcast. And they need your help. So we'll finish there, Henry. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. And from time to time, I love to talk about intelligence history on this podcast. So it'd be delightful to have you to come back sometime and talk about spies again.
It'd be lovely. It's been really good to talk, Nick. Thank you. Okay. Thank you again for having me on.
Take good care. All the very best. Bye-bye.